This is Limitless Possibility. I'm Luc Olivier Dumabre.
And I'm Yannick Marien.
And what's our topic this week, Yannick?
Sticky games.
Good, so we're breaking our promise again.
Well, it's been quite a while since our last video game episode, so I think it's okay by now.
Okay, that's fine then. And I know that before you start, you also have follow-up, so let's get into that.
Yeah, so first I'm going to start off with some graphics card news because, of course, everybody tunes into our podcast for graphics card news, all of the latest. I'm not too sure what the big reason is for all of this graphics card news all of a sudden because...
Wait a sec. I want to make something clear before you start.
Yeah.
That's the only reason I do a podcast with you. It's because of graphic cards.
Oh, so I know.
So I'm pretty happy that you bring me follow-up about graphic cards.
As everybody knows who's been listening to our podcast, AMD... and NVIDIA has been have been making quite a few announcements recently, and I think it's probably because they want the stuff to be known in time for E3, where more demanding games are going to be announced and demoed on these graphics cards. But basically, they've announced their roadmaps for the year, and AMD is quite interesting because they are appearing to concentrate on lower cost VR capable GPUs with their Polaris architecture. And it's sort of a surprising move by AMD because a lot of people thought that they were going to chase after the high end of the market, and it turns out that they're not. They're trying to make lower cost, more accessible VR GPUs for everyone, maybe to compete against PlayStation VR. I don't know, but it's pretty interesting to see them trying to lower the bar to access the best of VR right now. So that's really interesting. On the opposite side, you've got NVIDIA, which NVIDIA right now is at the top of the market, and they're really dominating with their Titan graphics cards, which cost a ton of money. But they are also rolling out some VR-specific hardware, this time more on the higher end of the things. EVGA is one of the vendors that makes NVIDIA graphics cards, because if you're not a graphics card nerd, you might not know this, but... AMD and NVIDIA make the designs, but they don't actually manufacture them. Other companies manufacture them, and there are multiple brands of NVIDIA graphics cards and multiple brands of AMD graphics cards. So EVGA... Go ahead.
Just a side note on what you just said. This just reminds me of the time I was... The short time I was a PC person, and I wanted to tweak and change parts of my computer and then realize that it's a complete mess because of this is one of the reason why it's a mess. But go ahead.
So EVGA is one of those companies that makes NVIDIA graphics cards, and they're releasing a special VR edition of one of the NVIDIA graphics cards, the GTX 970 Ti, which is currently one of the higher end graphics cards that NVIDIA is selling right now. And one of the interesting things is this GPU is going to have lower power consumption. They've tweaked the design a little bit so that the lower power consumption can be recycled into your overclock. So basically, you can keep using the same amount of power. It's just that you can overclock more, which is, I guess, gamer stuff. Another really interesting thing is this graphics card ships with an extra thing that you put in a drive expansion bay. Now, you might say, well, what does that give me, right? Well, if you've got an Oculus Rift, Oculus Rift hooks up to your computer via an HDMI port and two USB 3 ports. And if you don't have those ports in front of your computer, it can be kind of a pain to go behind the computer all the time. So the new expansion bay thing is one HDMI port and two USB 3 ports that you can just jack into your motherboard, and there you go. So that's really neat. And of course, the graphics card normally only has one HDMI port on the back. But they've also added an internal HDMI port so you can wire it up to the expansion bay thing. So really neat. The only problem with this is it's only really useful if you have an Oculus Rift. If you have an HTC Vive, the Vive has its own breakout box that comes with it, and it's required to power the headset, and all of those ports are already there, so there's no real reason to get this VR edition hardware unless you really, really want to overclock it for some reason. If you've got a VR headset right now, you've probably already got a GTX 970. So it's an interesting lineup of products that we've seen come out over the last week. And there's been lots and lots of discussion about how these new graphics architectures are in line with the PlayStation 4K, which is rumored and people can't shut up about.
Including ourselves?
Yes. There are lots of developments in the graphics card world right now. It's not particularly interesting, but I thought there were things of note because we discussed VR quite a lot recently on our show. Next up, of course, Apple Pay. Can't shut up about Apple Pay either. So Japanese Engadget had a pretty big article about potential roadblocks in adopting Apple Pay in Japan. And it's really interesting. It was focused more on the getting people on the train side of things than on mobile payments itself. And the NFC forum a couple months ago announced that they were basically trying to get all of the transit card standards to agree on a common technology stack so that, in theory, you should be able to use one type of transit card all over the world. Whether or not that actually happens is to be seen. But there was a lot of data that came out of those discussions from JR East, which is the railway in eastern Japan. And it's really, really interesting. So I didn't put all of the data in here. But naturally, just for the mobile payments thing, every single terminal that accepts Suica right now would have to be upgraded to support Apple Pay. So that is a big roadblock for adoption of mobile payments in Japan. But what if you only focus on the train, the train ticketing system? Well, the problem is Apple Pay doesn't fit into the strict requirements that were demanded by JR East. So Suica is made, well, Suica gates, rather. Each gate is made to accommodate 60 passengers per minute. That doesn't mean that there will be 60 passengers per minute, but that is the theoretical maximum of how many people can be accommodated by that system. And in the 1990s, when they were planning out the system, JR East studied Tamachi Station, which is a train station in Tokyo, and determined that basically 47 passengers per gate per minute is the sweet spot for that station. And it keeps everything moving at a reasonable pace. If that number was to drop down to 32 per minute, then all hell would happen because there would be so many people waiting in line to get out of the gates that they would be overflowing onto the train station, the train platforms, and that's bad. So basically, the latency, as we've discussed on previous episodes, 200 milliseconds to do everything, it's still too tight of a limit for most Western mobile payments and transit ticketing systems, and there is little hope that Apple Pay can be adapted into this. And the other thing, right, is when the NFC forum was discussing how to get one worldwide common standard, they were talking only about the technology. They were not talking about efficiency standards or any of that stuff. So it's unlikely that this will actually resolve anything for foreign technologies to be embraced in Japan, because Japan's standards are too high for the West. So that is our moment of depression for Apple Pay this week.
It's funny how you remind me of the ratio of people that needs to go through gates, and then I just reflect on my current experience with the Montreal subway and bus network, and it's just like, especially in buses here, you just present your card, beep beep, 5 seconds later. It's so slow sometimes.
Yeah, it's nuts. And the thing is, even when you're in Japan and you're in the train station trying to get from place to place, when you actually go on Wikipedia and look up the stations you go to and you look at the number of people who go through those stations a day, it is insane. And when you're there in person, you don't feel like it's insane because, again, those gates are really fast. People are in and out really, really fast, and you just don't notice that there are that many people, except if you're in like the heart of Tokyo at rush hour, then you'll notice because the platforms are loaded. But if you're not traveling during rush hour, you will never really know the volume of people who go through your station. And even then, you can be really surprised during rush hour how empty it seems relative to the number of people who are actually going through every day.
Yeah, it seems the right word would be like the fluidity of the whole system is just magic.
Yep, but again, you have to have really strict standards for that to actually work. And given our track record of contactless payments and all of that, I don't even think that we're going to reach that in the next 10 years. And I'm very sad.
Next point on your list?
That's it for follow-up. So I'm ready to move on to the main topic. Okay, so my topic is sticky games, and sticky games is not really a term that means anything, so I'm going to attempt to define it, because it's a term that I sort of made up.
Ray, that would be a good idea, because you should see my face right now.
Yeah, it probably is not something very work-safe.
So, Yannick, what are sticky games?
Right, so I've been noticing recently that there's this trend of gamers, and even people who wouldn't necessarily call themselves gamers, finding a game that they really, really like and sticking with it, and that's where the sticky comes from. They stick with it, and they hone their skill in that particular title, and becomes basically the game they play. Like, maybe they'll have little diversions here or there, but for the most part, they stick to one game, and that's what they do. And I've found that for myself, the amount of free time that I've had has dwindled significantly, and I found myself to be much, much more picky about what games I play. Not that I wasn't picky before.
We know about that.
But I'm even pickier now, and I think that I've sort of fallen into this category of people who play sticky games, in quotes. And I want to sort of talk a little bit about what makes games sticky, give examples of them, to ask you if you have some of these games yourself, and maybe talk about some of the links with greater trends in the gaming world. So there are three main, aspects to a game that make it sticky, in my opinion. High replay value, good mechanics, and a high skill ceiling. And all of those are sort of intertwined, so it's hard to actually separate them out into their unique things, but I'll try. So first off is high replay value. It's incredibly hard for a game to be sticky if there's no real reason to keep playing it. Games that have an end or that are mostly a vessel for some kind of narrative and have very little in terms of for lack of better terms, extracurricular content.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, like, after you've beaten the game, there might be extra side quests or a post game or something like that, which gives you more reasons to play it.
Or an online mode, for example, that would be a good one.
Yeah, that too. Okay, right. So it doesn't necessarily mean that the game needs to have a lot of content. So here's my big confession. I played Vanilla Destiny with no expansions for something like 160 hours. Now, one of the big complaints about Destiny, especially Vanilla Destiny, was that it had no content. It had basically 5 hours of gameplay content, and then you've beaten the game. I managed to squeeze 160 hours out of that. Now, how did I do that? Well, there are goals that are auxiliary to beating the game. You can chase the best gear in the game. You might actually want to chase specific stats on those pieces of gear to optimize your character build so that maybe your grenades can come out every 13 seconds instead of every 30 or 35 seconds. There's also, as you've mentioned, getting better in online multiplayer, which we'll get back to in a little bit. Multiplayer is definitely a big part of it for lots of people because competition is a good motivator for self-improvement.
Maybe we want to go back when we talk about online games, but still, it feels to me that most of the games these days are like you have kind of a main quest and then the rest of the game is assuming that you should play online and just fight with each other and be competitive with each other. It is where you will get the most value out of the game.
Yeah, and increasingly there are games that ship that are only online, like Overwatch, which I played over the weekend and I have been having a ton of fun with. Overwatch is basically Blizzard's answer to Team Fortress 2, and it's really good, but it only has an online mode and it only has competitive multiplayer. Well, I guess you can play co-op against another team with your friends, but you know what I mean. And it's only a multiplayer game, and I wouldn't bat an eye at it because it's like, yeah, of course, I take my money. but outside of multiplayer, you also have, I don't want to disparage these people, but you have obsessive compulsive people like the internet's famous Ulilia, who spend thousands and thousands of hours, and I'm not exaggerating when I'm saying thousands, play thousands of hours of single-player RPGs to max out every single stat on every single character, and even that is not enough. They need to find the optimal route in the game to get those stats to the max. And then often make very long YouTube videos proving that it is the that it is the optimal path by comparing stat leveling in different places. It's crazy.
Seems to be that stuff like you do.
I'm not that anal.
I'm just making fun of you.
I mean, I've done some crazy Pokemon stats stuff in the past. Sort of outgrown that because...
I do remember your Pokemon spreadsheet.
Oh, I still have a Pokemon spreadsheet. It's just that it's become a lot easier with the newer games to actually max out your stats in a way that is sane instead of insane like what you had to do back in the day. Anyway, outside of those things, there's also good mechanics. I get a lot of shit from people on the internet because I don't play games for story. I'm sorry.
Wait. What do you mean you don't play games for stories?
I don't give a shit about the story in video games.
Oh,
crazy?
My goodness. Oh.
I care that it's a fun game, and if it's not fun, then the story isn't going to make it more fun.
Okay. I won't stop you on that. Go on.
Okay. But anyway, that is only auxiliary to the point I was going to make, which is it's very, very rare that a game will have a 100-hour story that is actually good enough to keep playing to the end. There are notable exceptions. I think the Persona series is one of those games where a lot of people will say it's an 80-hour game, but the enjoyment I get out of the story is actually worth that 80 hours. You can contrast that with my personal experience with Xenoblade Chronicles, which is about an 80-hour game on the Wii and the new 3DS, which I played for about 11 hours, and the story was so brain-dead boring, and the mechanics basically didn't grasp me enough to actually make me want to keep playing 80 hours of it, so I just gave up on it 11 hours in. I know how the battle system works. I think it's a clever battle system, but it's not a clever battle system that will last 80 hours. And you have to be very careful about that when making a game.
I start to understand your point, and care if I go with an example?
Oh, go ahead.
Because I kind of have dangerous example, to be honest. And I think it's my own experience with Persona 4.
Yeah.
And I would say that the story is awesome, the gameplay is, but even then, if you need to convince me to play, like, what, over 100 hours to kind of... Or I think if you're good enough, which is...
I think it took me 73 hours to beat the game.
Okay, so, but from my level of gaming, I would tend to assume that I add maybe like 10 or 15 hours to those kinds of games. So like close to 100 hours, it's kind of too much for me. And
well, to be fair, I was playing the game in Japanese, so it would probably have been closer to my time because I had to look stuff up.
Oh, sure. But still, like I've looked at it and people was like, yeah, you can do it in 50. If you're good, and I'm like, oh my goodness, I'm sure it's like 75, 80 for me. And just the amount of time I need to invest in this is just a big turnoff. Even if it's the best game ever made, the investment in time is so big that it's just, I want to play and I want to experience it. And what happens is I start a game, play for a week or two, like intensively. And then after a week or two, something happens that I need to just focus my personal time on something else, and I just leave the game and never play again.
Yep, and Japanese RPGs are basically the biggest offenders of this, because the classics are generally around like 30 hours long, and that's like a good length, but there are also other classics like Dragon Quest VII, which, God, I don't know how people play that game, because it is like something like 200 hours. Beat the story. And just to get to the first battle, I was watching a Let's Play of it. It took an hour 45 minutes to get to the first battle.
Oh my goodness.
And like Persona 4 is not much better because it has an hour of talking before you actually get to take control of the character. Like that is one of the things that people really turn around about Persona. The difference is Persona's story is very heavy. It's very top heavy. You have to basically watch that first hour of dialogue to get an idea of if the game is even right for you. And if it is, then you'll continue to enjoy the story to the end. But otherwise, like, you're going to be, wow, this is anime bullshit. I'm turning this off right now. And it's sort of like the challenge you have to get through to actually get there. And that's another thing that's very common with Japanese RPGs. I hate to turn the show into the Japanese RPG show, but there's a lot of people on the internet who will tell you, oh, yeah, it starts being good about 10 hours in, or it starts being good about 30 hours in. That's what people told me about Xenoblade, is that, yeah, just play the first 30 hours and that'll be really good. And I'm like, I don't fucking have 30 hours.
Yeah, I think the best answer for that is, you know, with 30 hours, I could play all three first Uncharted before the fourth one gets released.
Yeah, or instead of playing this, three-star JRPG, and in 30 hours, in the time it would take for it to be good, I could go play a 5-star JRPG from the Super Nintendo era and be really, really happy about how I spent my time instead of 30 hours of this mundane bullshit to get to the good part of an 80-hour game that may or may not actually be good because you don't actually know if you can trust this person's opinion or not. So we're going to end the JRPG talk for now.
I completely sidetracked.
Yes. So what I was trying to get at is graphics and story may get you into the door, but what keeps you playing a game is it mechanically good? Because if it's not fun, then you're not going to keep playing. And let's be honest, video game writing, not that great. You could read a real book instead and it would be better writing. So...
Oh my goodness. Okay. You really want me to talk about stories, right?
No, I don't. Let's talk about the last point, which is high skill ceiling. So there are these terms in game design, skill ceiling and skill floor. Basically, those represent the range of skill at which a game can be played. The floor is the minimum viable skill level to actually enjoy the game. And the ceiling is the highest viable skill level possible. And sticky games are particular because they tend to have a really low skill floor to get as many people playing the game as possible, and a very high skill ceiling in hopes of either increasing replayability or increasing the size of the competitive multiplayer community. So part of what is great about playing games with incredibly vibrant multiplayer communities with lots and lots of players is you're just as likely to have players on the low end who are not very good like you, or you could have a ton of people on the high end who are professional gamers who are winning $1 million prizes playing the game. And that entire range is represented. Whereas if you're like me and you'd like Darkstalkers, which is a fighting game from the 90s that Capcom made and is currently played online by about 30 people who played it for maybe 10 years, if you are Mr. Noob me and you go into that community, you will lose 100% of the time because everybody has 10 years of experience on you. And it's not impossible to get better at the game by yourself, but it's very unlikely because you have basically no one at your skill level to play against and to slowly climb up that ladder. And that is an advantage that modern multiplayer games have with ranked matches and all that stuff.
Or just more volume of people playing the game.
Yeah, and it's not just limited to multiplayer. I keep talking about multiplayer because it's something that's pretty close to some of the games that I play, but stuff like leaderboards, stuff like speedrun communities that try to play games as fast as possible and beat each other's records, those are ways that you can basically, quote, mod games that maybe aren't designed to be particularly sticky into games that can be sticky by playing around with it. So if it's a game you really, really like, you're going to find a way to keep playing it, even if it's not necessarily something that was baked into the game to begin with. So now I'm going to get into some examples of some of my sticky games. And to be honest, there are only really two. But first of all, I'd like to ask you to go to you if you have any of those games that you basically got immersed in and kept playing for a really long time that took over your life, maybe.
That would be a good question, because I don't think it happened that much recently, and the only close example that would be that, but still, it will stop after maybe a week or two, would be, I always forgot its name when I want to reference it in this podcast, but it's the Zelda, I think it's it's not Twilight Princess, it's
Majora's Mask.
Majora's Mask, see? Every time. But, yeah, Tony wanted me to play to the 3DS version. I've did half of the temple for I think it's even then more than, I think it's more than 2 weeks. I played for it for at least a big month, like on and off. And still I was like, oh yeah. And then something happened and just never played again. And every time Tony's like, oh yeah, you should like restart your game in it. I was like, yeah, it's been what, 4 or 5 months since I stopped. So I think it's either try to immerse myself or I have to start again, which is a big turn off.
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily call that something like a sticky game like I had in mind. And once I name mine, maybe it'll be a little bit more obvious what I'm talking about.
To be honest, I totally understand that. It's the problem, I think, is I don't have any clear example because I don't think I have any sticky game in the recent year. I think the best example of a sticky game, if I was able to get it more, if I was able to own it for a long period of time, would have been the Uncharted 4 multiplayer beta. I think this game would have stuck so much with me, and hopefully
we'll see in a couple of weeks.
Exactly, we'll see about that. But that would be the close example that if I were to get it like a couple of months ago, I'm sure I would still play some of its online player on multiplayer online mode at least once a week.
Once a week, okay.
Sure, it seems small, but for me, playing for like 2 or 3 hours once a week is kind of a big commitment, but maybe we'll come back on that later.
All right, so I'm going to start with my first example. This is not going to be a surprise for most people listening to this show. Beatmania 2DX was the game I played for all of college, most of high school. Like, that's pretty much all I did.
Is it close to 10 years now?
I've been playing over 10 years, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I unfortunately don't have a count of how many hours I spent playing 2DX because only the most recent 2DX games have the stats feature that actually keeps track of how many hours you played. And as of last year, I have amassed a complete collection of the PS2 versions of Beatmania 2DX because the last ones, 2DX, DJ Troopers, and Empress were the two last ones to be released. And DJ Troopers and Empress cost a fuck ton of money nowadays to buy, even used. Like, a used copy of DJ Troopers cost me $100 2 years ago.
Oh, my.
And Empress is generally around $280 to $300.
Used. Ouch.
It is ridiculous. Luckily, I bought Empress when it came out new, but I had skipped DJ Troopers. I had to buy it for $100 last year, and that's only because I've been searching for 4 years.
And what is the reason why those games are so expensive? Limited availability?
Empress was the last game to be released by Konami on the PS2, and it was fairly late into the PS2's life. I think maybe there was like sports games, but otherwise it's like the last game that isn't a sports game to be released on the PS2 in Japan. DJ Troopers, I believe, had a smaller print run than the other games, and that's why it's rarer. And of course, it's also in that last batch of PS2 games because they didn't want to move over to PS3 for whatever reason. They experimented with Xbox 360 in North America for weird-ass results, but that's different.
But this would mean that those two games got released, what, not even 5 years
2008.
ago? 2008. Oh, okay, so it's not even the 2010s.
No. It's 2008.
Okay, so, but still, like at that point, the PS3 got released.
I believe it was 2006, late 2006.
Yeah, it's fall 2006, so it's like it was still in the beginning of the PS3, but like 2 years after. So it's quite surprising that it got released on the PS2.
Huh. Yeah. Unfortunately, I mostly had to stop playing 2DX a couple years ago because my wrists really weren't taking it anymore. 2DX is probably the worst music game in Konami's lineup for wrist pain, I would imagine. I mean, I play all of them, and 2DX is the only one that routinely gives me wrist pain, whereas the others don't, so take that as you will. And my performance kind of plateaued for several years near the end, because, like, at the point where I was, it was really just I was hurting myself to get better at the game, and that's not good, so I had really to stop playing. But I was going to start to beat 11s, and that's on a 12-point scale for difficulty, and relative to a lot of other people I know in the community, I progress very, very slowly because I have very weird hand positions for a 2DX player that is right-handed. But it's what I feel comfortable playing in, so I don't know.
Regarding that statement, not the ends one, but more the difficulty one.
Yeah.
Is it me or it is kind of a common, not misconception, but a common problem with music games? Because it was always something that I felt problematic with the Western games, Western music games that I've played. Either it was Guitar Hero or Rock Band, and even when I tried to play 2DX with your setup, it always felt to me that at some point you'll hit a plateau, and then you'll plateaued a bit, and then you need to do something either magic or you kind of start to hurt yourself to change your end position to kind of move along and move away from the plateau.
Yeah, in the music gaming community, we call those things walls. So I don't remember the exact wall values because it's been so long for poppin' music, but I think there was like a 41 wall and a 43 wall and something like that for a 50-point difficulty scale, where you hit those points and you're like, you have to basically learn how to read these patterns, which are so much more complex than what you're used to seeing. It's not necessarily a question of hand position. It's just you have to be able to process what you're seeing in a way that makes sense. Like, how do I transform the image that I'm seeing into the hand positions or the fingering position or whatever that matches that pattern? And that is mostly what music games are. It's memorizing patterns, and you don't memorize like the entire chart to a song. You memorize the patterns that come up often in songs, and then the stuff that really throws you off is stuff that doesn't really fit a pattern that you're used to, really. And there are varying scales for this. Some games are, we call them, if something is easily passable just by looking at it, we call that sight reading. If stuff is easily sight read, there are certain games that are easier to sight read than others. For example, Groove Coaster is a iOS and arcade music game by Taito. And one of the very peculiar things about that game is, as the name implies, it's sort of like a roller coaster, how the game progresses. And each song has a different roller coaster you ride along and tap the notes to. How this manifests itself can be wildly different and very, very tailored to an aesthetic of a song or something like that. So, for example, there's a song, TGM in a Bottle, which is a background music track from Tetris Grandmaster that is in that game. And that entire thing, you are basically riding the sides of Tetris blocks. And the first time I played that song, I failed it because it was insane. I was not expecting to actually like have to read the sides of Tetris blocks where the notes are and try to follow where I am on those blocks. Groove Coaster is a game that I would find very, very hard to sight read. On the opposite side of the spectrum, you've got stuff like Guitar Freaks, which especially the old Guitar Freaks only had three buttons. So you don't have very many patterns to memorize. It's just you have to be able to strum fast enough to actually be able to hit the notes. So there's a wide range of music games. What I feel is that Western music games always were more about being good party games than about being long-lasting, challenging games. I've seen many, many people who have been year-long Drum Mania and Guitar Freaks players who played Rock Band, who played Guitar Hero, and they could destroy every song on the game, like basically when they got it, because relative to the Japanese equivalents, those charts are very, very easy. And like, I can do most hard and expert charts on Guitar Hero. I cannot begin to touch the top half of Guitar Freaks and Drum Mania charts. Like, it's completely different in terms of difficulty. And that is sort of like how I feel Japanese people have really said, like, this is a game that is going to be a long-lasting experience. You can have a, quote, career in this game that will last tens of years, and you will still have stuff to aim towards. And I'm getting to this because one of the hardest boss songs in the game, in 2DX, I mean, is called May. It was added the year that I started playing, and it took the West 10 years for a single person to get a AAA on that song, and it happened this year. It was my friend DJ Hood. He got the first AAA on May Another, and it took him 10 years.
Yeah, I think congrats to that guy, to be honest. I'm surprised, but it's surprising that you said it's the first person in the West to get it. How long did it took for someone from the East to get it?
It was a lot less than that, but I don't remember the exact figure.
Okay.
I want to say it was something like 2 or 3 years.
But still, okay, 2 or 3 years is quite long, too.
Yeah, but it's a hell of a song, and it's like really tricky. And they can keep adding other weird and hard boss songs to the games. Like, they do. They try every year to add a new boss song to the game. But that year, they went really, really hard, and they broke people. And there are some even more obscene things in the home versions that technically some people don't even count it as part of the game. They're like, this is too bullshit to actually count as a real thing. Whether or not you do or don't, I don't really care. It's hilarious. I would probably destroy my wrists if I tried to play it, so I probably shouldn't. I got an F on that song, by the way. I checked my score yesterday.
Oh my.
I think my score was like 22% top score of the maximum score you can get, and that's like nothing. So yeah, 2DX, it was a big game. I played it. I've technically been playing it off and on for 10 years, though I want to say maybe for 6 years I was playing it like several times a week, and it was basically the only video game I played for those years. And I don't want to say I got good at it, because I mean, I'm about average with regards to where Japan falls. The cool thing about 2DX is there is a ranking mode where you can go and play different Dan courses from 7th Q to, well, I guess it's no longer 10th Dan, but whatever. Sort of like karate rankings. And I am somewhere between 7th and 8th Dan, which is about the average for Japan. So that's more or less where I fall right now. But I'm not really going to get better because I care too much about my wrist to play that. Instead, I play Sound Voltex when I'm in Japan, which has enough variation in movement that it doesn't hurt my wrists, and it's just as fun, so that's good. Moving away from music games, because I could literally have an entire podcast about it, lol. Destiny is pretty much the other one, obviously.
I was waiting for this one.
Yeah, so I counted the number of hours I played Destiny over the weekend. I've played 700 hours of Destiny in a year and a half.
Oh my goodness, 700?
If you add together the amount of money I spent on a PS4 and Destiny expansions, it cost me about 74 cents per hour.
Oh my goodness.
Of which is course. Pretty good.
Sure. Of course you calculated the...
Of course I did. It has to be a good investment, right? And
I'll be honest with you. It's not a good investment if you're not able to get it lower than 50 cents per hour. So you need to work on that, Yannick. You need to work on that.
You're terrible. I'm going to have to spend money on Destiny this fall, too, so it's going to go up.
So you need to work now. Not to work. You need to play now. Come on. Stop this podcast and go play.
Oh, my God. I'm never going to do anything but Destiny if I do that, and I'll burn out, and then I won't want to play it. But anyway, about playing Destiny. Activision, when they announced alongside Bungie that they were going to be doing Destiny, they said, we have a 10-year plan for this game. This is going to be a 10-year series. And I am fairly certain that I'm going to keep playing Destiny for those entire 10 years because the game is so fucking good. Now, when I say it's so fucking good, I don't actually mean it's so fucking good because that would be a lie. But notoriously, Vanilla Destiny launched with a Polygon review of 6 out of 10. And it became sort of the meme between both Bungie and Polygon writers to just like whenever anyone says something and complains about Destiny, they just put the logo of the 6 out of 10 from the review in their tweet and it just became a meme. And like I'll often make reference to it. Sometimes I'll be talking to, hold on, I have to go play my favorite 6 out of 10 first person shooter game as rated by Polygon.com. But yeah, so one of the great things about Destiny is that Bungie, they are really, really good at what they do, and they built one of the most mechanically sound first-person shooters on the market today. Once you play Destiny, you cannot go back to other first-person shooters because they feel like shit. The gun feel in other games feels completely devoid of any weight or personality. And that's something that's kind of particular about Destiny. It's trying to blend massively multiplayer online gaming with first-person shooters, which is something that a couple of people have tried, but they've never really succeeded at, whereas Bungie really sort of got it. Guns in Destiny are as much characters of the game as the players themselves. And part of what makes Destiny really strange is because it's a living, breathing game that gets balance updates every quarter, and the community is very vibrant. Certain weapons have developed their own stories within the community. So I'm going to give an example from last year. Last summer was really, really hard because basically everybody was using the same two guns all the time because they were too good. There was Thorn, which is a pistol that you could use, and if you shot them, they were poisoned for like 4 seconds and they continued to lose health over that time. So there's that. And the other thing is, of course, if you basically shot someone 2 headshots with that gun and you were guaranteed to die, basically. The other thing is there were high-range shotguns, which were another problem, which is you could basically be several meters away from a person, shoot them with a shotgun, and they were dead immediately, insta-killed. Whereas other shotguns in the games prior to the introduction of high-range shotguns, you had to be much, much closer. And if you were at higher range, you were dealing much less damage and you couldn't kill someone right away. I realize that now that I'm saying it, that this sounds completely stupid if you are used to real guns, but video games.
Sure, and it kind of fixed the only problem a shotgun has. It's like, it's short range. Voila, yeah. You have a long range shotgun. Haha.
Yeah, and that was sort of a problem. It became basically like this crazy weapon that you could wield and be basically within 5, 6, 7 meters of someone and shoot them, and they would die, guaranteed. And everybody was rolling with this. So that one of the problems with it is Destiny was always trying to cultivate this culture of gunfights that feel like you have a chance of winning, because they will drag on long enough. They're not insta-kills like in Unreal Tournament or in Call of Duty or games that have very, very quick time to kills. Time to kills in Destiny should be relatively long for first-person shooters because they want you to experience the gunplay. They don't want you to get shot and then rage quit. And the problem, of course, with these two guns, the shotguns and Thorn, was that this brought the time to kill way, way, way down. They were like maybe a half of what the normal time to kill was. So if you're going to use any gun, you're going to take the gun with the smallest time to kill because you don't want to lose the gunfight. So everybody was using Thorn and everybody was using high-range shotguns. And basically that became like this big villain in the game. Everybody hated Thorn. Everybody hated high-range shotguns. And it sort of became this story, this narrative that we tell each other in the community that everybody fucking hates shotguns. But everybody uses them because they don't have a choice. And then Bungie releases a game update that says, hey, shotguns aren't good anymore. So that's cool. And then one of the strangest things about this year is when they released the last expansion, which was the Taken King, every gun from the first year of Destiny, basically, their power level became too low to be competitive in the multiplayer arenas that have level matchmaking on, which is complicated. But basically, each gun has an attack stat on it, and in certain player versus player events that stat will count, whereas in normal multiplayer that stat doesn't count. So people who are using year one guns or who have just started playing the game can still be competitive against people who have beaten the game and are at max level. So those guns were supposed to vanish out of sight, so Thorn was no longer a threat. Hallelujah, game is now fun again. What happens?
Well, they bring another gun that is kind of the same.
No, they actually learned their lesson for this. For the guns that were extremely problematic in year one, they have not brought them back, which is a great feature. But a lot of other popular guns that people liked from year one have come back in year two. But the big problematic ones that they haven't figured out how to, quote, fix, those are basically non-existent now. There was also a rocket launcher called Gjallarhorn, which was extremely hard to get because you could only get it randomly, and it had a very, very low drop rate that everybody wanted because it was so overpowered that basically any boss in the game could be destroyed just by shooting Gjallarhorn rockets at it. And they accidentally released a boss basically that you could not play all of the strategic elements that they put into the boss fight because the boss would already be dead by the time that those elements would come into play. So there were entire like boss fights that were ruined by that gun. So they got kind of pissed and they said, yeah, that gun is not coming back. But anyway, so what happens in year two is that the class of weapon, the hand cannon that Thorn was, got nerfed. And they said, these guns are too good. We need to bring them down a peg. The problem is, of course, that Thorn was so crazy overpowered that it was still the best hand cannon. So everybody resorted to Thorn again. And you had this crazy thing where people were using Thorn in year two multiplayer, even though it wasn't competitive because it was actually still more competitive than year two guns. So all of these stories and stuff like that are part of the community. And I think that I'm maybe a little bit too aware of what goes on in the Destiny community because of how many hours I've played and I've researched the game and everything like that. But as you can probably tell by the way I'm talking about it, I love this game. It is so good. And
are you trying to say that this whole episode is about Destiny and you convincing me to play Destiny?
I don't even have any intention of convincing you to play Destiny because I don't think you play enough for it to actually be a good game for you, a good fit for you.
Oh, I'm surprised too. I'll be honest with you, I'm surprised a little bit though. I know that you would like that I know that you would like if I were to play this game. Still.
I think it's too much of a time investment for you. And I don't mean that in a I have 700 hours and you don't way. But it's more like, I think there is a lot of tedious work in Destiny that doesn't really need to be there. And that I'm willing to put up with it because I like the game when I have those weapons so much.
But still, you can say that you have 700 hours to invest in this game, and I don't. And I'll take that as a compliment.
Yes. So what do I do when I play Destiny? I mean, I this game, basically, right now, it's year two. They've released a couple expansions. I want to say there's maybe 12 hours of game content total now. So again, I was talking earlier, we started with 5 hours and I extrapolated that to 160 hours. Now there's about 12 hours of content. I extrapolated that to 700. Where do we go next?
I seriously don't want to know.
Well, too bad.
Because I'm sure it will be like 1,000 hours and like, oh my goodness, 1,000 hours. Oh. So, okay, go on.
Okay, so I'm about average at online multiplayer. I was not always average. I used to suck really, really bad at online multiplayer, but I've gotten better at it. And one of the great things about Destiny is the guns feel so good and the game is so well polished that I have a blast playing it even when I'm having losing streaks. So every month there's a PvP event called the Iron Banner. It's a week long. It starts on a Tuesday and it ends the following Tuesday. And you have 1 week to basically grind your way to level 5 by playing lots and lots of multiplayer matches where you can win really, really strong gear by playing those games. And it's one of those events where the power level of your guns count. So what am I doing between Iron Banners? Well, I'm making my guns stronger by getting higher level gear and infusing them into the guns I like. And getting more stronger armor and all of that stuff. I have 3 characters on Destiny. That's how I've sort of gotten to 700 because I have like 200 on one character, 400 on another. And I guess the math doesn't add up quite exactly, but the rest of them are on the other character that I don't really like as much. And I basically try to get all of those characters up to competitive levels. And then every month I choose a different one. So this month I'm going to be doing it on the Titan. Next month I'm going to be doing it on the Hunter. And the month after that I'm going to be on Warlock. And I'm going to rotate these characters so that the multiplayer stays fresh. But I can keep playing with different guns and different character types and different abilities and keep the gameplay fresh. And
you're still investing in all of those characters' abilities and kind of making sure that they evolve at the same level each player, but still they kind of evolve with you while you play with the game.
Yeah, so 2 weeks ago, a month ago, Bungie released the April update, which was a significant content update for the game, which basically raised the max level from what it was previously. And what that means is that I am now chasing max level. I was not max level before, but now I'm chasing it and it's a lot easier to achieve max level. So I'm almost max level on one of my characters. And then after that, it's just going to be chasing max level on those other two characters so that I have the highest stat gear in the game. And then when the new content drops this fall, I'm going to be able to destroy everything from the start because I'll already be at max level for what was the current content. So I can start leveling again right on top of that instead of having to dig around for stuff. So I don't want to drag this on too much longer. Those are my two examples of games, but I do want to make a link with esports.
Maybe before we go on esports, it's nice that you showed your example because it reaffirms the fact that I don't have any sticky game. And I think if I were to kind of try to get one, and bear with me for a sec, but it wouldn't be a game, but it would be a whole series, and it would be the Gran Turismo series.
Oh, definitely.
Because it would be games that I've played for the last 10 years. Maybe not every week or every month, but at least I'll have a period of kind of rage playing. I really play it so hard and so long, and then it will go away, but it always come back at some point. And with the new versions, with new updates to games recently, it is always something that will come back.
All right. So esports. Esports are likelier to be sticky than any other games because the entire point of esports is that they're competitive games, and for a competitive game to be good, it has to be a game that you want to keep playing for hundreds or thousands of hours, either in training or on the tournament circuit or just for fun. So
it's like real sports.
I'm not going there. It's not atypical for people's sticky games to be one of the following: League of Legends, Dota 2, StarCraft 2, Call of Duty, Street Fighter 5. All of those are sort of the hot esports right now. And those games have huge communities of people striving to be better, good support for ranked ladder multiplayer. And whether you like those games or not, they're very well engineered to be games that stick. And I'm trying to get into Street Fighter V. I've mentioned this on the past. Street Fighter V is sort of this contested installment in the long-running Street Fighter series where the gameplay has returned to basics to make it more accessible to lower-skilled players like myself, which is part of why I want to get into it, actually. But it also has a lot of really crazy stuff for competitive players to do, and it's a game that's always sort of really appealed to me. The thing is, I would have started during Street Fighter 4, but the problem is Street Fighter 5 was already announced around the same time that I would have gotten into it, and the game is going to be very different anyway, so there's no real point in learning the end of Street Fighter 4 when you can start learning the beginning of Street Fighter 5 and go from there. And I've always sort of been a fan from a distance of fighting games because I think that mechanically they're very interesting. The thing is, it's fucking hard to play. Like, I understand that Street Fighter V basically has tripled the windows for how wide your timing needs to be for special inputs, which is great because I suck at doing very specific timing for stuff on an arcade stick. If it was a music game controller, like, fine, I can do that shit. But if it's on a joystick, screw that. It's completely different. And I've been trying to get into it. I'm not doing a very good job. Occasionally, I will tweet screenshots while I'm playing online on Street Fighter V, where basically I start with 300 or 600 ranked match points, and I lose them all, and I am back at unranked loser who lost like 13 games in a row, and it still stays fun, which is why I keep playing, but I'm not very good at it. But again, sort of like Destiny, I'm going to keep working at it until I'm at a level where I feel decent, and as long as I keep enjoying the game, I'll keep playing it. And yeah, I think that you're seeing a lot of sticky games nowadays because esports are sort of dominating the top end of video games. You're seeing really this huge imbalance between huge AAA and video games and esports at the top end of the thing, and then tiny indie games that are 3 to 6 hours long, maybe, on the low end. And I think that if you actually stick with a game, then you're more likely to take little breaks once in a while and play those small indie games. So they complement each other very well. The problem is, if you're a fan of the games that are in the middle, which I tend to be, those games are vanishing very, very quickly, and it's unclear what they're going to do to survive. My guess is they're not going to survive, and you're going to have to subsist on retro games, which is why I have my crazy retro game set up, and you can go listen to that episode if you care about that. But that's about it for now.
It's surprising to me that you didn't mention the kind of lead... I'll go this way. The leading gaming platform these days.
The PC?
Smartphones. Yes. Because it would fit to me that sticky game is kind of one of the biggest genre of games that would generate tons of revenue and are being really, really popular these days. And it kind of also fit into the category of free-to-play games.
Yeah, well, esports tend to be more free-to-play, especially MOBAs, which is interesting. So this weekend, I tried to download Paragon on the PS4, and I had a terrible experience because I did not realize that Paragon is in early access until who knows when. So you can go download it on the PlayStation Store, but you can't actually play it. Of course, I only found this out until after the 4.5 hours of downloading and installing the game.
Oh, crap.
Yeah, so you get to the screen after like staring at this progress bar that tells you, hey, what's your early access code? And I'm like, early access
Oops.
Code, what's that?
Oops.
So I am currently like begging on the internet for an access key for the beta. Until I get one of those, what's actually kind of strange about Paragon, a strange little thing, is they're shipping a box copy on June 7th, but I don't actually think if you buy the box copy, you're able to play the game because it won't be out of beta yet. I'm not sure what the deal is here. But that just seems very strange. So Paragon is a MOBA by the Unreal Tournament people, Epic Games. And it's appealing to me because, first of all, I don't like the aesthetic of most MOBAs. I think they all look sort of the same, and Paragon tries to be more futuristic and sciencey than the others, which is good for me. It's also a third-person game where you can control your aim, so it becomes more like a third-person shooter combined with a MOBA than it is just a pure MOBA, which MOBAs are top-down and are basically versus tower defense. So it gives a little more action to the MOBA flavor. And to be honest, it's sort of the popular thing right now. We're seeing Overwatch, which, as I mentioned earlier, is sort of Blizzard TF2, which has some MOBA-like elements. There's Battleborn, which is by the Borderlands people, which is much more shooter plus MOBA than anything else. And then you have this Paragon, which is more on the MOBA end, where you have less control of the shooting aspects of the game and more of the MOBA management stuff. So it's sort of interesting to see how those genres are sort of converging, or in trying to find some originality in the MOBA genre, because the top three MOBAs basically are completely fucking identical except for the characters. People are trying to find like what is the cool new spin we can put on MOBAs to make them cool and to attract more people. And I think that is good, because MOBAs are not necessarily a bad genre, but all of the ones that are out right now don't appeal to me. And that's really interesting. And all of those are basically free to play, and you buy new characters or you buy skins that are cosmetic and all that stuff. And I think that increasingly you're going to be seeing that for a lot more things. I've complained in the past, Street Fighter V probably should have been free to play, especially since Capcom fucked everything up and they didn't actually manage to get their in-app purchase store up on time. So you can only buy stuff with free currency you get in the game right now, which is very, very strange. They completely screwed up their business plan by releasing the game too early before the microtransaction stuff was ready. So now the only way to get stuff in the game is to play the game a lot and a lot and a lot and a lot. You can't actually exchange real money for stuff, which is the entire point, I guess, because they wanted to make it sort of free-to-play-ish, even though it's a $60 game. I don't get it.
Though it has the upside of creating the habit onto the people's habit, right? Like, if you need to play to be played to get currency.
Yeah, the problem is you don't actually get currency unless you win, and you need to get, like, several thousands of wins for it to actually amount to anything that is good. But I guess you can accumulate fight money that way. I mean, I'm saving my fight money for when my favorite character from Street Fighter 4 comes out on Street Fighter 5, which is probably going to be in a year. So I'm going to have a ton of fight money. Well, not that much because I lose all the time, but that's another thing. But yeah, so phone games, I didn't really mention them because I think that free-to-play phone games are in a much different genre. They're much more puzzles and less, I think they're more for quote casual gamers than for hardcore gamers, but both of them more or less follow the same model of free-to-play, maybe cosmetic app in-app purchases or some kind of method to control access to a resource that is only available with real money or given in very small quantities by the game. I played Vainglory this weekend, which is a iPad MOBA, because they released a patch with a mode that seemed interesting. And first of all, I would like to say that they have gone so far since the launch of that game. I remember installing Vainglory when it first came out on my iPad, and they had this tutorial which made no sense whatsoever, and I had no idea how to play the game at the end of the tutorial. But I won against another player who was also playing the tutorial and very confused as well. Very strange experience. But as I keep reinstalling the game from time to time to see how it's evolved and stuff like that, now the tutorial is really, really good and streamlined and gets you understanding the game's principles very quickly, partly because of the new mode they added, which is much more simple, and they put you in the simple mode first instead of putting you into the main game mode immediately. They've learned a lot, and I think that it's really, really accessible to people who've never played a MOBA before, which is, I mean, it's decreasing every day because MOBAs are an increasing part of the gaming market. But if you've never played a MOBA, Vainglory is a good game to actually see if you enjoy that genre or not. But I mean, aside from that, I don't really play that many smartphone games anymore because they're just not appealing to me in the genres I like. And
oh, sure. And the main reason why I was mentioning smartphone is, I'll be honest with you, one of the games that I play tons and tons on my iPhone is the new SimCity, which is a typical free-to-play game. But what? I've been playing it for months now, and I will always go back and play.
Maybe that's your sticky game.
So, yeah, and then this is where I realized that it might be it. Because I always play it, and it feels to me that for tons and tons of people these days, those sticky games would be either Farmville or any, mention any like free-to-play IP that you can think about on the App Store.
That reminds me, did you see Jean-Michel Ancte's letter on Minion Rush? Oh, it's not Jean-Michel Ancte, it's some other French-Canadian comedian that I forgot the name of.
Okay, no, I did not.
Jean-François Mercier? Yeah, I
think so. Oh, yeah. Him. Okay, yeah, yeah. No, but I didn't see the letter.
Oh, my God. So, for people who don't know, Jean-François Mercier is a comedian here in Quebec, and
he's pretty known to be vulgar.
Yes, and he is a big fan of Minion Rush on Facebook. He spent $700 on in-app purchases for Minion Rush in order to get the highest score in his friends list. And he integer overflowed the score, so now his score is negative and he's at the bottom of the thing. And he wrote a very angry letter to the developers of Minion Rush saying, this is unacceptable. I spent $700 and all I get is wind up at the bottom of the leaderboard with my negative score.
Oh my goodness, that's so funny.
So there you go. That's a good way to end the show this week.
Oh, it is. It is an awesome way to end the show. So, I'm sure Yannick will put that letter in the show notes. So, where you can find the show notes? It's on our website. So, this episode show notes will be at limitlesspossibility.net/40 because it's our 40th episode. Yes! Hey! 40 episodes! Also, you can find our other episodes and other show notes regarding those episodes at limitlesspossibility.net. You can find the show on Twitter at @limipo_podcast. That's @limipo_podcast. You can also find myself on Twitter at @lucconouche. That's @lucconouche. And you can find Yannick at
Sakurina, Sakurina.
See you in 2 weeks.
See you in 2 weeks.